Welcome to Parents' Perspective. Mrs. Evans, Joey's kindergarten teacher was on the other end of the line, I think you might want to come to school tomorrow morning. Oh, dear, Joey's mom sighed. Is something wrong? Well, not exactly. It's just that yesterday our class talked about children who were needy, and the students volunteered ways they could help. They decided on a clothing drive. Each student would bring an item or two he or she had outgrown so they could accumulate enough to take to the local shelter. That sounds like a fine idea. Didn't Joey bring something in? I know he and I went over a few items he could take, Mrs. Evans replied. Oh, yes, he was quite interested. When his father brought him to school this morning, he proudly explained that he had emptied the entire contents of his bureau into a box, and he was planning to donate all his clothes. From a parent's perspective, how can we most effectively teach our children to be charitable? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest today knows a great deal about volunteer work and charitable activities. Robert K. Goodwin has served as president and CEO of the Points of Light Foundation since July of 1995. Points of Light works to engage every American in helping to solve serious social and community problems through volunteering. Bob has one college-age daughter. Welcome to Parents' Perspective.
Thank you very much, Linda and Sandy. It's great to be with you.
What do we mean when we speak of charity or being charitable?
I think everyone recognizes the term charity as having to do with giving, giving to others in need. And being charitable, therefore, implies being willing to share of your resources with someone else who is less fortunate.
There's a wonderful Hebrew word called tzedakah, and it's used as charity, but it really means justice.
The idea of giving as a responsibility is gaining in currency, if you will. There is an old Celtic saying that we warm ourselves by fires we did not build. We drink from wells that we did not dig. An old Irish proverb says that it is in the shelter of each other that the people live. And we are observing and hopefully influencing the tendency for more and more people to accept their responsibility to be giving, not only of their material resources, but certainly of their time, which is where our real focus is as a national leadership organization, because it is an obligation, because we have been so richly blessed, particularly in this country. And those benefits or blessings cannot reasonably be sustained unless there is this idea of sharing, which in turn is the most predictable way to ensure equity and parity and justice. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a great wisdom in the Hebrew notion that you've shared.
When is a child old enough to understand personal giving?
Some children, for whatever reasons, come to this understanding at different ages than others. But I think that most reasonably, not long after, they understand the notions of self. When a child begins to acquire or have a desire for acquisition for their own comfort and their own pleasure, it is not long after then an opportunity for them to understand the parallel or the contrast to self. I was with a friend not but a few days ago, and it happened to be this friend's three-year-old daughter's birthday. And it was so instructive to observe her clear understanding that this was a time for her to receive presents and that everyone in the room was there at her pleasure. And she was quite quick to point out that reality. And it occurred to me, not necessarily in preparation for this wonderful program, but just generally, that it will not be long thereafter the opportunity for her to begin to understand what is in direct contrast to her needs and her wants and her interest, and to thus be able to emphasize the importance of others as an alternative. And thus, I think her mother has a chance to begin to give her some teachings about her ability to focus on others' needs and not just her own.
We had a very interesting example of that in my family this summer. My niece turned 9. And, of course, for months in advance, it was, you know, what would you like for your birthday? We'd want to get you something that you really would like to have. And finally she said, I'm a pretty lucky girl. I don't need anything. But if you would make a donation in my name, then I could feel like I'm helping other people. So, of course, she's very young. We said, you know, what kind of charity? Where would you want, like us to make a donation? We thought for sure she had heard something on television or something. She said, I don't know. Just find a charity that helps children.
I think what is important is that there are stages of understanding. And my answer was targeted toward when you begin to formulate an alternative to notions of self. That sense of an alternative may not become fully expressive. I think 8 or 9 years old is a time when a young person, a child, can more clearly make the association with their responsibility and what a charitable act really looks and feels like. Whereas before that, you're simply building on that sensitivity to others as an alternative to self. There's some wonderful examples, thinking of your own, as you shared it, Linda, of how 8 and 9 and perhaps even 7-year-olds are able to make choices about sharing because they do recognize that they are fortunate. This past Halloween, for example, and so soon after the horrific events of September, there were several stories that I heard, and I'm sure other of your listeners did as well, of kids who said rather than trick-or-treating or rather than simply going to get candy, we'll collect money, which in turn will be used to benefit children who were affected by the tragedy. There are so many examples that our organization comes into contact with of kids who, through that same sort of realization, make a judgment to start a program, whether it's selling lemonade and using the proceeds. There was a wonderful story, as an example of this, of a little girl in Kentucky, I believe, who at the age of 9 years old, recognized because of some personal experience that she had, that there were so many children who were in the foster care system who had to put all of their worldly belongings in garbage bags and who decided to raise money to give suitcases for those kids because it's understanding that their self-esteem was perhaps wrapped up in those garbage bags, and has now started a national program that has won many national awards, some of which from our organization or the organizations for which I have participated. So I think there are a lot of those kind of examples where 8 and 9-year-old children have been very deliberate and very mature in their judgment of what they can do as a charitable act.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion about teaching children to be charitable.
Two excellent books written by hosts Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis, Parents as Mentors and Washington, D.C. with Kids, are available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents' Perspective. We are talking with Robert Goodwin about teaching children to be charitable.
What are some other effective ways to introduce charity to a youngster?
Depending on the age of the children, there are what we would consider appropriate activities that first help to establish the value system, which then in turn helps to serve as a foundation for other specific opportunities. You can take a 3 or 4-year-old to a nursing home, for example, and just let them derive the satisfaction from seeing the expression on the part of a patient at having company, particularly a young person who almost always bring a smile or some cheer to an older person. And that's something that they can do because they see this as an elderly relative, or it becomes a familiar experience, which can then lead to other potential charitable or volunteer activities. And we would say that doing something like that up until the time that you're 3 or 4 years old is important. At the ages of 5 or 6, you might have a child to sort or pack bags of food at the food bank. Once again, they can accompany a family member who will take on some related responsibility. But that's a task that a child of that age could do. And at age 8 or 10, walk dogs at an animal shelter. At that point, perhaps even assist an elderly neighbor raking leaves, running errands for someone who is homebound or in need. 11 or 12 might be able to help start or work in a community garden, till or the soil or plant bulbs or maintain a family garden, and then share the produce, share the bounty. So there would be different stages of service related perhaps to the same project. By the time a youngster becomes a teenager, there are literally an infinite number of things that can be done. And what is most rewarding is to see the innovation and to understand some of the ideas that the young people themselves come up with, maybe building on a theme such as from examples already shared, or realizing that a classmate is in need of a surgery and developing a fundraiser to throw off proceeds to support that child or their family. Mentoring a younger person. Your notion of parent as mentor certainly has relevance for the power of mentoring as it is experienced by others. And teenagers can be wonderful mentors to middle school and adolescent children. We had canned good drives in high school and then solicited other students to help develop the baskets and, as importantly, to deliver the meals. And what we're finding today, the variation even on that idea, is to once you have established contact with someone who is receiving the services and goods, make a connection, establish a relationship, because it is the power of relationships which have the potential to change lives.
That leads into our next question, which is really about the difference between something that's a task-oriented activity and a financial donation. How do you feel about that for children?
I think they're both important, and charity and philanthropy today does connote both giving of money and time. There is a relationship between charitable giving and volunteering. We find that people who, as adults, volunteer are more inclined to donate because there is a connection. They understand the benefit of the services that are being provided by that nonprofit organization or charity.
Which comes first, the chicken or the egg?
I think that probably more people have been inclined to give money, and then from that experience find, for a variety of other reasons, the motivation to become involved as a volunteer. But then once they have volunteered, they are more inclined to give more money than they might have otherwise. Mm. Now, obviously, it works in reverse for some, but I think that's probably the way it happens. So there is this natural and complementary tie or relationship between time and money. It's probably easier for young children to learn the principle of giving by giving money. And so whatever the parents can do to encourage the child to give to their church or their synagogue or their mosque or to some charitable effort that the family is connected to, out of their allowance or out of money they earned for odd jobs and so forth, that's just a good principle. And it goes a long way. It's something very tangible. It's something that small children can begin to try to comprehend. You know, if I take one for myself, then I'm going to, you know, set aside something, some percentage of that one over here for somebody else. And that's more easily taught, perhaps, with money. But our thought, and certainly value, would be that as soon thereafter, as soon as you have established a contrast to the notion of self, and that others have value and that others can benefit from something that you do in their behalf, to get the children thinking about service and volunteering goes a long way toward building their understanding of what community means, what their responsibility as a citizen means, what their role in helping to strengthen community bonds, what that really means. Because service and volunteering, one way I've described it, is the currency which helps to sustain the social contract. It is the thing that anybody can do which has the effect of bridging the chasms which divide. If you stop and think about it for a moment, we believe that at the root of our most serious and seemingly intractable social problems is the phenomenon of social isolation. People who are estranged from one another and from the bonds of community, we call that disconnection. And so if disconnection is at the root of the problem, then fostering connections between people, particularly those who are not like one another, is at the root of the solution. One of my favorite authors is a metaphysical writer that you may know, many of your listeners may know of her works, but Marianne Williamson. One of her books is called Illuminata, and she makes a very profound statement, I think. She says that the antidote to that which is fundamentally wrong is the cultivation of that which is fundamentally right. My wife teases me and says, Bob, that's, that's not so profound. And I think in its common sense, it is in fact profound. But if people living in isolation is the root of the problem, then connecting with others are the solution. That's what service is all about. And the earlier we can begin to demonstrate and model that behavior for our children, the more they have a grasp of what they can do to improve the quality of life of our communities.
Bob, is it a good idea for a family to decide on a specific charity for a period of time and have all the family members involved with that charity in some way?
I think that the notion of family volunteering is a very powerful concept today. Our organization, the Points of Light Foundation, has been somewhat of a pioneer in the concept of family volunteering. We actually have a program called Family Matters, and it's about not only how to recruit family members to become engaged as volunteers, but also how to work with the nonprofit organizations that use volunteers to be sure that they are getting the most out of that volunteer resource. And we therefore have a lot of tools and best practices and ideas that families can turn to get at the heart of your question. It is less important, in my judgment, of whether or not the family makes a decision that we're going to work on one topic with one organization over a long period of time, for example, as opposed to the family saying that we're going to dedicate a certain percentage of our week or month or year to volunteering, and that within that commitment, we will make room for a variety of potential activities. So it's more important that the commitment be made and that the family unit agree together of how they're going to approach their volunteering than I think necessarily